Hi, my name is Mike, and this is The Goods. On this show, we go inside the minds of designers, makers, and creators at work in the world today. Here is where you'll get interviews, ideas, and insights from the world of design, creativity, and invention. You'll discover new methods and mindsets that you can use to bring your ideas to life. Today, you'll meet Stephanie Prevost, Director of Interaction Design at Code and Theory in New York City. Stephanie is an incredible design leader with over 20 years' experience at some of the biggest, best, and boutique agencies across the East Coast of America. In this episode, you'll learn what interaction design is and how it works, how agencies are evolving in response to COVID-19, what Stephanie looks for in emerging design talent, and a whole lot more. If you're curious about interaction design or living and working in New York City, this interview has something for you. This is also a two-part episode. Both parts will be about 40 minutes long and released at the same time. That way you can listen at your own pace or all at once. You get to choose. If this episode inspires you, please pass it on. If you like the show, you can get even more at thisisthegoods.com. That's where I post show notes, transcripts, and more, and you can get it all for free. That web link again is thisisthegoods.com. Okay, I hope you have your note-taking app ready because there's a lot up for grabs here. So let's get into it. Please enjoy episode 7 of The Goods with Stephanie Prevost. Welcome to the show, Stephanie. It's so great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'd love to start off with understanding a little bit more about the work that you do. Can you describe that to us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently the Director of Interaction Design at a digital creative agency in New York. So Director of Interaction Design is specific. There's a couple of pieces to the puzzle. One is that I manage a team. So there are junior level designers, mid-level and senior designers underneath me. So some of my job is just regular old management, career progression, making sure they have what they need for projects, that kind of thing. So that's sort of the director part of the title. And then the interaction design part is really around, it's going to sound ridiculous, but designing interactions, what it is. It's how someone comes to an app or a website or, even a space, like a retail space, and how they interact with it. So where do they go first? Where do they go next? Where do we want them to go? What do they need from us at that moment? So really trying to get into their heads, from an empathetic angle and say, oh, how can I make this better for you? More interesting, more valuable. At the highest level, I guess that's the interaction design side.
Oh, awesome. And can you speak through a little bit more about what you mean by empathetic angle?
So I think one of the reasons why I love, the field and the discipline and what we do is that I'm 9 times out of 10, I'm not the ordinary user who'll be using this product or going into this store or using this app. So it's been interesting that working at an agency is that you get different types of clients from different walks of life. So you get a finance client or an automotive client, and everyone has different needs, but we're all kind of human and we all sort of have the same basic issues. Like, we don't like to be confused and we like to find what we need and we're interested in certain things. So if you put yourself in, empathy is the base root of all of it. And if I can put myself in the shoes of someone who wants to go buy a motorcycle, even though I've never even sat on one and I'm not interested in ever buying one, but what can I do to stretch myself to think about, like, what is it that they need? What is it that they need to understand this purchase? And that's the empathy side of it. You got to go outside yourself for, 90% of the problems.
When you say going outside yourself, what does that look like in practicality?
In some cases it's tactical things like, asking the client to pay for research. So you're actually hearing from users. So asking them to spend some money on that or finding ways to kind of do it in-house with friends and family and just say, you know what, can you just show this, our target is a, 55 to 80 year old couple. Can you show this to someone you know in that age group, in that demographic, in that, mindset? But really trying to show what we're doing to a broader audience of just, and not just us, not just me, me just looking at a designer's work and say, well, I don't like that. I wouldn't do it that way. Like, that's good for you, but you're not the target. So it doesn't matter.
So opinions really don't matter that much.
you know, there's, I think after a while there's gut instinct and there's best practices, and I've been doing this a little over 20 years. So there's some things that you can kind of lean on. But if you can get some research and testing in, all the better. And it, you, there, you'll always find something, especially if you go global and do cultural testing as well. There's always something that pops up that you're not going to think of. You know, it's, there's just always value in it.
Yeah, like the things that you least expect tend to show up sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And what's your favorite toolkit in your arsenal to work with, to lean on?
You mean like software programs and that kind of thing?
It could be a skill set. It could be an approach. It could be a framework or a workflow, a skill, a tool.
That's a really good question. I think, like in terms of a skill set, I think when you, like if you're wanting to come into this field, for example, there's some practical things like learning how to create the deliverables that are inevitably on our plate to deliver. So there's some documentation that we're typically responsible for. That to me is sort of the easiest piece to teach. There are tons of best practices there. There are a lot of toolkits, there's templates, that kind of thing. The software piece changes every couple of years. I've had, you know, in the last four agencies, I've used at least five different pieces of software, and we're always learning new ones. They're always new ones are coming out. So you just have to kind of be open to be fluid on that one. So that one I wouldn't say is like a definite. I think the skill set piece are the soft skills. I think within project teams, interaction design or user experience, I think it's like a very meta thing where we also have to, we play a role within a team that plays up to a client and their business needs, but then also down to a developer and their technical needs. So we're a little bit of a connective tissue between a project team as well. So I think that's really hard to teach. I think that's why some people really do well in the field and some people really don't. It's not typically a heads down, go in a corner and do what you need to do for 4 weeks and come back. It's typically very collaborative, very open. So I think in terms of the skill set, I think that's what makes people shine in the discipline.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned that the tools tend to change like every few years. I'm really curious about like, what is the metric that you use to determine what tool to use next? Because there's some element of like future-based thinking where you have to anticipate where the tools are going and kind of adjust your teams around that, I imagine.
Yeah, I think if I look back at where it started and where I started to where it is now, the key is efficiency, and anything that can make the workflow faster and more collaborative and let people in outside of you. It kind of goes back to that same, you don't go off in a corner for a month. And the tools that we've been moving towards, even literally in the last 3 months, 6 months, that's the tipping point is, wait a minute, this is going to make us faster, more efficient, more collaborative. Let's try it. The base tool set hasn't changed dramatically. There's some minor nuances and keyboard shortcuts that don't always carry over, just enough to drive you crazy. But what they can do tends to be the same. Like, you know, there's squares and arrows and lines and whatever, but they're the ability for other people to see me as I'm working, for example, and have it cloud-based is a big deal. Being able to send a link to a client and allowing them to view and comment on it so there's no version control issues. Things like that are what's kind of pushing newer pieces of software to the forefront right now. And then it's always a little bit of an uphill battle because you want everyone to jump on it, but you can't flip a switch one day and say, as of Monday, everybody uses this thing. So there's learning curve and there's all those pieces to it. But I think over time, that's what I've seen the most is about efficiency.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess there's like a lot of training and testing and experimentation with tools to see what you can kind of get from it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what does your typical day look like? Maybe even right now in the era of coronavirus, we're actually talking and, you know, you're taking the interview from your car at the moment, and you've got, you're doing a lot of travel at the moment, as we were talking about off the interview. Can you talk through a little bit about what it's like right now for you?
Wow, this is, definitely not typical anymore. So I'm married and I have two little kids, so my day's pretty hectic. I have a kindergartner and a 3-year-old. And my day actually starts pretty much with the kindergartner's 8:30 class. And then I try to get some work in after that. Then he has a 10 o'clock class. So these are all Zoom meetings for him. And at that when those happen, my husband goes offline. He does the class. I take the three-year-old in another room. And we try to divide and conquer that way. And then my life really at this point revolves around my meeting schedule. So I look at the calendar for the day, tell my husband when I need to be offline. He tells his coworkers when he needs to be offline or all those kinds of things. So we can divide and conquer the kids stuff. Then if there's any heads down work where I like really need to concentrate, then it's kind of done after bedtime. And then the next day we start all over. So really my Google Calendar dictates, has a little bit of a domino effect. It dictates quite a bit of everyone's day-to-day life right now.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like you and your husband both work as a really great team to, you know, not only manage the expectations that you have at both your offices and works, but, you know, the expectations that your children would have about, you know, their time and their attention and their fun too.
You try. But it's definitely the three-year-old has no understanding of what a quote-unquote important meeting means.
What do you mean by that? Like, I've heard stories about work-at-home mums with their children and how their children's come in and, like, you know, obviously they want attention and things like that. What's it actually look like for you?
If it's something that really needs to get done in peace and quiet, I've learned that I need to leave, which is why I'm sitting in my car right now. If it's something that it's short and that like my husband can handle because it's only like half an hour or so, then those I do from the house. My three-year-old has appeared on many a internal meeting. He just kind of pops up in the back. He asks to see my friends. He wants to wave and, you know, do that kind of thing. My five-year-old understands a little bit more of what it means. And then likes to get rewarded for, you know, not being a pain. But they're getting a little bit more used to it. And they now do ask, like, do you have to go do some work? Do I have to be quiet because you have to do some work? That kind of thing. But they're struggling, too, I think, because before, when you have a 9-to-5 type of thing, you leave the house and they don't see you. And they're off doing their own thing. And they have friends and they're busy. Now it's like, well, we're together, but you're ignoring me. And I'm really confused about that. So. I think it's mentally, it's been hard for them to understand what this means, why we're always on the computer.
Yeah, sure. I can totally imagine how hard that would be for your children. And like you mentioned in our pre-interview that you've been doing some interesting projects with your son that involve a lot of cardboard. Can you share a little bit about what that looks like?
Yeah, we've actually upped our game since we talked. The last time I talked to you, we had done a parking garage, a three-floor parking garage with an elevator. And then last weekend was a holiday weekend here in the States. And unfortunately, it rained. So we really upped the ante. We had already had a house. And then he decided he wanted a kitchen. So we have, But not just like the kit. We did a blender. We did a coffee pot, a stove, a refrigerator. Luckily, my parents had a lot of extra cardboard boxes and a lot of recyclable stuff. So, we've done quite a bit, actually, in all those arenas. And he pays attention to details that I wasn't aware of, like the heating element on the stove had to be quite right, like had to be like little squiggles and on the top and the bottom, and made pots and pans. We've done a lot.
It sounds like a really beautifully intricate, almost like piece of art or a diorama in a way.
Yeah, yeah. You could say that.
Oh, fantastic. Definitely sounds like a great project to have in isolation as well. Something that you can, you know, create over time together and share and enjoy. And I guess that would be a little bit of a benefit of being home a little bit more. Like you do have that opportunity to share those creative experiences. And it sounds like it's a lot of fun too.
Yeah. There is a piece of it that I really enjoy. There's also a piece of it that's absolutely maddening because I'm pretty sure I gave birth to a creative director. So he's got some ideas. But I've started to ask what his vision is and then we go from there. But I'm a little
fantastic.
Yeah. I'm definitely more on the execution side. But it's working out. We're in a rhythm now. It was a little rough early on, but we're a good team now.
Oh, that's so great. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the early part of your career. What kind of drew you into the agency work that you do now?
I'll date myself, but when I was in high school and you're looking at colleges way back when, they actually gave you this big book, like it's like a telephone book with like that thin paper material. And I was looking at college majors and I really didn't know what I was that interested in. And I saw that advertising was a major and I was enamored by this idea that you could get paid for that. So went to college, was a communications major, did a semester abroad in Madrid, and was lucky enough to get an internship at Saatchi & Saatchi in Madrid doing some research around a debit card. And I was fascinated by it because culturally they didn't use credit cards. So people would actually pay in cash, like they'd roll up someplace with a big wad of cash, and that was just not, you know, the American way. So I was kind of fascinated by this different way of kind of operating. And they were trying, Visa at the time was trying to launch a debit card, which would sort of satisfy the mentality that you're not putting something on credit, but you also don't have to carry cash. So then internship was actually, looking back on it, quite basic. It was just about research. We put together a presentation and whatever. But after that, that was my junior year. I came home, finished out with a communications degree and a sociology minor. And then my first job, though, was an administrative assistant at a mortgage company in Boston. Yeah, and it lasted about 3 months, and I was bored stiff. And I called the recruiter and said, I'll do the same boring job, but can I just do it in an advertising agency? And that recruiter said, no, you need to stay there. What I didn't realize is that she didn't get paid unless I stayed for 3 months. So I hung up and I called a different recruiter and said, hey, listen, I'm fine doing this kind of work. Like I'm filing and making copies and making coffee and answering phones, but can I just do it in a different place? And so I got a job at what is now Digitas, but at the time was called Bronner Slossberg Humphrey. And it was just doing that but I was on the account management team, for AT&T. And that's what I did that for a year. So I liked the agency world as soon as I got into it. I thought it was interesting. I liked the idea that things changed all the time, that the clients changed, that, you know, one day you need to learn about AT&T, the next day I had to learn about FedEx. It fit for me. But then I wanted to get into the creative side of things, and I didn't really have any background at all. My communications degree was really, really wide. I was at a liberal arts school. Like it ranged from media to stuttering and cluttering and communication disorders. So it was just, it was way too wide to be considered like any sort of solid background for, to become a go to the creative side. So I asked my manager, my first year, my manager said, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I want to go into creative. And he said, well, you got to go talk to this creative director on this other floor and see what he says. So I talked to him and then he said, well, you know, maybe you could become a writer, but, you know, go take some classes, read some books, whatever. And you can job shadow. So I job shadowed for about a year. And what he let me do was go into these creative briefings and really get the assignment. I'm sitting alongside an actual writer and the actual creative team. He said, then go off and do it on your own whenever you're done, you know, because you have a full-time job. So whenever you're done and come grab me in the hallway and show me your work. So I did that for about a year, and that eventually got me into the creative department in an agency world, and that's where I haven't left since. I've bounced around within the creative side, but that kind of drew me. I think there were two things. One was the projects changing, the clients changing, and then also the being on the creative side of things as well.
And what was it about the creativity that you were really drawn to? Because you mentioned that this mortgage company was pretty boring. is there something about the agencies that you really found appealing that you wanted to be a part of?
Yeah, I think it was they were just informal in comparison to what else I was seeing. I had a lot of friends that went into finance or banking, and I had some friends that were, you know, doing odd jobs like at a law firms, and they wanted to become lawyers. And it just, everything felt so rigid. And even in the mortgage company, it was, you know, every loan is basically the same thing and had the same elements. And, you know, there was a little negotiation around it, but nothing that I was that keen to stick around to see. I liked the idea that there was a playfulness and, you know, we aren't saving lives, but I kind of was more comfortable with that. And I liked it. I liked the people. We laughed, we joked, we took things seriously. There was a work ethic mixed in there, as well, but it was a good combination for me.
And when you say work ethic component mixed in there, what does that mean? Is that the work hard and have fun kind of idea, or what does that look like?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the late 90s, early 2000s, before the bubble burst, and even I think afterwards, there was definitely that sort of mantra, the work hard, play hard. But I think it's funny, what I think drew me into it is also probably what frustrates me now, or, you know, experience kind of pulls back on. But the idea that you can always make it better, and other people's ideas can, like, you show it to your manager, your boss, and they make it even better. And you're like, this is awesome. Like, well, oh, if only, you know, we could do a little bit more. And then you always run out of time. And I think what I've learned finally is that you don't always have to do that. Like, there is a moment where you can be like, no, this is solid. You can stop now. I think that's really hard for creative people to stop sometimes.
Yeah. It reminds me of the quote that's attributed to Picasso, where he says that great art is only ever abandoned. I'm probably completely butchering that, but the sentiment I think is there.
Yep. Yeah, it's hard to walk away. It's hard to stop. It's hard to, you know, walk away from the computer and let it bake for a little bit. But there's a piece of that that I liked. And then I think that's also kind of what drives me nuts about it now.
Yeah. And why did you decide to move from Boston to New York?
That's a good one. That's I actually blame my husband for that. He had lived in New York before. And we weren't married yet, but we were both in Boston, and he wanted to move back. And he is a kind of a classic New York story where, you know, apartments are really hard to find and everything's so expensive. But his aunt had a apartment that she was subletting out, and she was going to get rid of it. And then he said, no, wait, hold on. Maybe we'll take it. So we found the apartment first, and then we found jobs to match. So,
oh wow,
yeah. Then we stayed there for about a year, and then we moved to a different apartment. But it's kind of classic New York, which is the apartment's more important than the job in some ways.
And has the city changed much since you moved?
So I moved 15 years ago. It was 2004. Or I guess almost 16 years now. I'd say the industry has definitely changed. I think the city in some ways, it's funny that we just moved out a few years ago, to Hoboken, which is just over the river in New Jersey. I'd say our neighborhood that we were in the same place for 13 years. I'd say that neighborhood changed pretty drastically, but it had gentrified pretty significantly while we were there. But the industry changed quite a bit. It went from my point of view, it went from like very big players to a lot of medium-sized players to a lot of medium and small-sized players. Sentiment changed quite a bit on the creative side. Like when I first got there, I kind of wanted to be at a big shop. And then over time, you're like, no, I really want to go small. And then I went medium, and now I'm back at like medium to big. So I kind of bounced around a little bit, but I think I probably followed a bit of a wave within the industry as well.
And what do you think triggered that wave? Is it the tools and the ability to do this kind of work is becoming easier or more accessible for people?
No, you know, I think I was a little bit, I think it was all just cultural stuff. Like I liked the big agency gives you that sense of security that there's an adult running the show and that there's, you know, there's money to be funded and, you know, you feel a little bit more secure. The smaller ones, it feels like you can do anything that is needed. So there's a little bit less politics. You don't have to ask permission so much as, you know, ask forgiveness. There's, a lot more of that informal creative piece. but there's instability. And, you know, so there's always, I think I got caught up in a little bit of the grass is greener. Let me go try this. Maybe, you know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears kind of thing. Like, this is too big. This one's too small. This one's just right. But you have, I think it's, it worked for me, I should say. Maybe it's not for everyone, but it, bouncing around a little bit like that helped me figure out what it is that I wanted. And for what I wanted right now, you know, what I want right now isn't going to be the same thing as I want in 5-10 years. So.
It sounds like you really value spontaneity and maybe being unencumbered by process.
I think not so much unencumbered, like wild, wild west and do whatever. But I like the idea that if something isn't working, you can have the latitude to fix it and not get stuck in the we've always done it this way trap. Unless it works. If there are pieces of this puzzle that work, that's fine. Like, leave it be. But I don't, I kind of bristle at the, well, this is just how we've always, so we have to. And in the guise of making things more efficient and make things better and faster and all those, you know, those good words, sometimes you do have to just think of something from another angle.
And it sounds like you really enjoy the pursuit of continual improvement then.
Yeah, I think so. I think I didn't always. I think I'm more comfortable with it the older I get. I think I've realized that it's not as scary. That when you do that, nobody knows what they're doing, and that's okay. I think when you're younger, you're looking for more guidance. You're looking for the, like, oh, wait, they've done it that way. This is great. I'm just going to follow those footsteps, and, you know, I'll be successful too. It just changes, I think, as you get older.
And you reinvent and modify and adapt and remix things together and try and experiment, right? It's a really exciting field to be in for that, if that's something that you're really naturally drawn to. I'm curious about your background a bit deeper, because you've mentioned writing and content, but we haven't talked a lot about design and interaction design. And I'm curious if you can talk us through why you made the leap from content strategy and writing into design.
So I didn't make it on my own to start. I didn't even think to do it. I had a really great boss at the time who pulled me aside at one of my reviews and said, you know, I really think you'd be, at the time there were, the discipline was information architecture, so IAs was the name of the department. And he said, I really think you'd be great at this. The way the process works in an agency is typically the IA gets sort of first crack at what the site should be, the website should be. And they're putting together like a site map of here's all the pages and here's the general structure, and this should be in the navigation, and this should be in the footer, and this should be on these pages. And then they hand that to the writer or the content strategist. And so I was always receiving these documents. And so I was always moving into design was really moving more upstream. So he told me this one year. I said, no, thank you. I don't think it's creative enough. I'm not going to be interested. I'm going to get bored. And he said, okay, let's just wait and see. So the following year, literally a year later, he said it again. And he said, no, but this time we're going to change the department to interaction design. I'm going to hire another manager out of our GA who will sit and train you and will give you the skills that you're missing. But your head works this way. Your brain works this way. This is better for you. At the time, it was we were in a digital, I guess, department or, you know, enclave within a larger agency. And at the time, what they were doing organizationally was breaking that wall down and making it a true integrated agency. So he said, listen, I'm about to get a bunch of new writers from the other side. And it's not that I don't need you, but I have the writing box checked. We have some people leaving on the IA side. So I'm going to be short on this new interaction design department. I want you to be a part of that. And this time I said, yeah, let's try it. So, and really haven't looked back. I did miss writing for a little while. The content strategy was a little bit of a stopgap on my way over because of this one particular project we were working on. And it allowed me to just get into a little bit higher level content mindset and not so much about the writing and a little bit more about the organization of it, which was a natural path into the interaction design world. my next job was, I think the title was user experience, and then same with maybe the next one. And then now I'm back to interaction design. So I've bounced around a little bit in the title world.
Yeah. I think titles are interchangeable for a lot of people in the design industry at the moment. Like there's product designers, UX designers, interaction designers. It's all over the shop at the moment. When you made the switch from content strategy into design, what was going through your mind at the time?
You know, it's interesting that when I got the title, I remember thinking that I'm not a designer. Like, I don't get it. Like, I don't design anything. I'm not a designer by nature. That's not who I am. But in my head, that was like graphic designer, art director mindset. And they're like, well, no, this is still design. You're not doing colors. You're not doing photos, but this is still design. And it took a lot for me to warm up to that. I didn't feel like I was worthy of it, frankly. It was such a high prestige title to me. I kind of had the same thing when I became a writer, that I didn't feel quite right either. Like I had to sort of earn it over a few years. And then I remember that with interaction design, it was a similar process where I felt like I really had to work hard at it to kind of gain my own respect, I suppose, of the title.
And what you just mentioned is really interesting too, because it's something that when I talk to others that are unfamiliar with design, there's this, I think, a misconception that all design is creative design, like artistic and flair and flourish and that kind of stuff. But there is this other side of design that is usability and practicality and systems and structures and information and organization and this whole other component that is almost like hidden behind the seams, which it sounds like that's what you really work through as a interaction design director.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. I think it is a behind the scenes design. It's meant to clear paths for people so they don't even feel like it's been designed in a weird way. I think it's meant to be in the shadows almost, or, you know, invisible. And then you only notice something when it's wrong. So it's frustrating that way, because then people always just find what's wrong. But a really well-designed thing. And you know, you see this with like Disney and Apple, and you see people that you go through like, oh, look at that. Like, you know, and there's like this weird surprise and delight element. And that's because it's been designed, even though it feels like there's nothing there. That it was just so easy. So yeah, I think that it's the behind the scenes element to it. But the word design does tend to come with flourish and color and, you know, font styles.
And preconceived ideas about who a designer is, I guess. Now, I know you mentioned it a little bit at the start of the interview, but I'm hoping you can like break down interaction design a little bit more for us and explain it in how it works. So you're an interaction design director. You work with a team. What would someone on your team be doing day to day?
Code in Theory, where I am now, is a little unique in that an agency has a user experience department, and that covers a really wide range of skills. Instead of focusing that just on one department, it's more of a mindset of the entire agency of we're all here to serve the user and figure out what it is that person needs and what their problems are, et cetera. So in this context, interaction design is just one slice of the experience puzzle, if you will. And it's very specific to moving someone through a flow, through actions, through, you know, point A to B to C. So if you're selling shirts and shoes, it's about making sure that you find the product, you get the size you want, you understand if it's in stock, you get the price, and you keep moving through. And that I have like an end goal in mind of that user journey, if you will. I think it's very focused interaction design, because it's like I was saying at the top, it's really the your interaction with the tool or with the site or with the app or whatever it may be. User experience is a little bit broader, more of an umbrella. I mean, that's that could be the system design, that could be even it'd be the content piece of that, the taxonomy. So how everything, you know, you're on a big news publication site and there's a lifestyle section, and you know, all the articles that have to do with lifestyle are tagged lifestyle. So there's a content strategy team where I am that worries about that. That's not the interaction design side so much. So we're, I guess, broader in that way so that we have people that are dedicated to each of these individual areas. So interaction design is a little bit more focused on literally the user paths and actions and moving people through those flows.
Yeah, and I guess what I can really hear and what you're saying is the interaction designers on your team are focused on removing friction and blockers and things that inhibit people from taking those desirable actions for that side.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other piece of that is to translate all of that to a developer or an engineer and making sure they know what it is that we're trying to design in a way that they understand. And that's a really big piece of our day-to-day job is what I always say is landing the plane and saying, okay, so we have this great idea. This is what it's going to look like. And we have a visual designer who's doing the flourish, if you will, and evolving our core ideas into something even more beautiful. But someone also has to document it for the engineer who's like, okay, what are we doing here? I know what it looks like, but how is it going to function and flow? So that's another piece of it too.
Yeah, and what are some of those challenges of landing the plane, so to speak, that designers would have to deal with in that handover experience?
It's really the crossing the T's and dotting the I's and making sure that we thought of all the edge cases and, you know, everything from what if they, let's say they enter a zip code to find something and your product isn't available in their area. What message do they get? Do you ask for more information so you can follow up later? What does that follow up look like? What if they, you know, they put in an email address and there's not a domain name? Like literally going through all the ifs is something that I see people who are really good in this discipline and really enjoy it like to go down all of those paths, almost to a fault. But it's like, okay, what if this happens, this happens, this happens, and it's a Tuesday and it's sunny? You're like, okay, hold on. We got that covered. And we're able to answer all of those little questions when a developer asks. I think the struggles are when everyone falls in love with a design or an idea that hasn't been put through those paces. And all systems are go and the client loves it, but that thinking hasn't been done yet. And then you got to backtrack and you're like, well, I know you wanted it this way, but it doesn't work for whatever reason. A system's not in place. A database isn't updated. There's some technical something that just hasn't been thought about yet because they haven't had time to think about it yet. And I think that happens a lot. And I think it can happen. It puts developers in a really bad spot because they're the ones that everything's rolling downhill to them really, really fast. And then they've got to make sense of it and, you know, turn the lights on somehow. So I think that's why our bridge to them is really important.
It sounds like asking the question, what if, a lot really helps the whole process.
In all directions. I think it helps early on when it's, you know, here's the business problem and the user need that we've trying to solve. And you're like, okay, what if we just did something else entirely? So that what if up front is really important to kind of open the doors. And then also downstream when it's, you know, what if they enter this, but they really mean that? And is that confusing? And what if they're on a phone and then they go to their desktop? Like the what ifs come in on both ends.
And are there any other key questions like what if that you regularly ask in the process?
Will they care? Does it matter? Okay. I think we can go down a rabbit hole of thinking something's really cool and then it's over-engineered. We put in too many options, all with the best of intentions, but sometimes it's very easy to over-engineer something because you get really excited, but it may not be a core functionality. Is it too much, I guess, would be one of them. Too much too soon. I think that the MVP method, mindset is really hard to do. So that the minimal viable product, what is the least amount of work that we need to do to solve this problem? And then what comes next? I think the order of events is also another one, you know, the what comes first. Yeah, there are a lot of basic questions we ask, and I really thought about it.
And are those questions asked in workshops and in the collaboration experience, or is that questions that you would ask of the users when you're doing research? And how does it all kind of come together?
I'd say those are a lot of internal conversations. I think a client usually comes to us with obviously a problem. Sometimes they come with their own research and their own issues that they know they have. Sometimes they come with a solution and we have to back them up a little bit and say, well, no, what problem? And they might be right. They just all, or they might be wrong, but you got to kind of get to the root of the problem.
You gotta stress test it.
Yeah, yeah. And we're really good about doing in-person, well, or remote as the case may be, but collaborative workshops with the client where we get to the root of these problems, because we don't always have the answers, especially if it's a new client or a new industry or a new target segment that we're not familiar with. You know, client comes to us and they know their business. They're coming to us for a very specific need. They don't come to us so we can learn everything there is to know about them and know more than them in a short period of time. I mean, that's ludicrous. So we got to help each other out. So I think we ask them with the clients, we ask them internally. I think with users, it's just a shorter list. You don't try to get them to solve your problem, but you do try to get them to react to it or potential solutions, just to kind of dig into things, kind of prompt them for their points of view. And sometimes you get a solution out of them too. Like, God, why couldn't it just be like X? And you're like, good point. You know,
thank you for that.
Why can't it? I'll look into that. Thanks. So I think it's across the board.
Well, this has been huge, but everything good must come to an end. If you liked this episode and want to hear more, you can get the goods on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast network or listening app. Thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Mike signing off.